Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Kurt North and I am here with you yet again to talk about another episode. This time we are talking Season 3, Episode 3. And it's, depending on how you want to look at it, it's either the end of the world as we know it or Teotihuacan, or whatever you want to do to pronounce that. Joining me today, before we get into any further details, is Adam Chamberlain, returning again. From the back end of Season 2, well, you were last on, Adam, in Amnesis. So we've had The Time Is Now. We've had The End of the World. And surprisingly enough, The End of the World didn't happen. How are you doing? And just your general thoughts on the Season 2 finale, quick overall thoughts, and your relationship with Season 3 and how you've come to... to either love, hate, have an ambivalent feeling on Season 3, and just the millennium as a whole.
Great, sure. Yes, hello. And yeah, it's great to be back. Thank you for having me back. So I was a big fan of Season 2 and a big fan of that finale. But in terms of my relationship with the series, I came at Season 3, I guess, quite late. So I'd watched Season 1 from the... I bought the videos, which are on a shelf behind me. I still love them dearly, so they're on display on a shelf behind me. I watched Season 2 as it transmitted here in the UK, thanks to a brother who had access to Sky at the time. But then... I think because I'd moved away somewhere. I'm not sure where and when Season 3 transmitted in the UK, if indeed it did. But I had no access to it at the time, so... excruciatingly, having loved that finale as much as I did from Season 2, I found myself unable to see Season 3 and just read articles, reviews, read the synopses on the official website, on the Millennial Abyss, and kind of resigned myself to the fact that I would never see most of Season 3. There was then the... there was the X-Files Millennium episode, and that got released here in the UK. Again, as a video, as a VHS release with...
Oh, yeah, I have that somewhere, actually.
Yeah, I don't know that I still have it. Foolishly, I think I got rid of that when I upgraded my X-Files collection from video to DVD, foolishly. So that's crazy that I no longer have it. But it had the final two-parter from Season 3. So having not seen any of Season 3 and just read snippets online, I then watched that two-parter and then the X-Files Millennium episode. And it wasn't until the DVDs came out several years later that I finally got to see the season in its entirety. And at that point it was like a bonus that I got to see it at all. So I lapped up Season 3. It was almost a season I thought I would never get to see. And I do appreciate Season 3. For those who say they wish the series had ended at the end of Season 2, well, it almost did to all intents and purposes for me, and it kind of sucked. So, I had that sort of distance before I'd seen it. So I guess I know for some people the beginning of the season sort of jars. It didn't for me, partly because I knew what was coming. I've just appreciated that it exists at all and that I got to see it and watch it over and over. So, I am a fan of Season 3. It's that sort of merging of some of the approaches from Season 1 and Season 2 in a way that, I think could have run beyond Season 3 quite happily, but of course, sadly didn't. So, so no, I'm very much here to celebrate season three.
Well, that's good to hear. yeah, I mean, I've mentioned on the first couple of episodes that I'm not as harsh on season three as a lot of people are. I spoke briefly about the innocence and exegesis and how some of the sidestepping is interesting. Some of the themes are quite liked, and something we'll touch upon in the end of the world as we know it, when we get into the episode, on how I find it's quite interesting how they didn't push this as much as I thought they could have, but they kind of looked at the first two-parter as a two-parter on theme of mother and daughter. And yet this one seems to be like father and son, but I don't think they push it that as much as they could have, really.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, there's certainly, that whole thing around parenthood. I guess we'll get into it. There are some interesting instances of father and son, but then that are contrasted with Frank and Jordan as well. Obviously, father and daughter in that instance that I find interesting in here. But that it comes up a lot, doesn't it? The whole parenthood and next generation in season three, and this is a good example.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting. From the last rewatch that I did, that obviously I wasn't looking at it in that aspect. I wasn't going to be doing this podcast at that point when I rewatched it originally. It was more a case of I've managed to transfer the DVD onto something that I could watch whenever I wanted to watch it, and I kind of like sort of went, right, okay, brilliant, I can now watch Millennium whenever I want to, kind of thing. And it just kind of happened. It was like, oh right, okay, I've started with the pilot, and then before long, you know, I'm into 522666 and I'm going, right, I think I might be watching this right to the season again. I remember getting to The Time Is Now, and I must admit that season three for me was a bit of a blur, and still is. I still can't quite remember when I watched it. I'm pretty sure I watched it when it aired. But it's interesting you say about that double parter and the Millennium video, because I'm not entirely sure that we had Millennium at the time. It's similar to what I had with the X-Files around the Anasazi trilogy when the VHS came out for that, where it was the unopened file, where I didn't see most of season two until later on. So I got to see the Anasazi trilogy via that video, and it was only when I went back and watched season two that I actually got to the end. But I've got a feeling that something with the VHS or the way that I watched Millennium Season 3 is that I might have seen the end two-parter on that video before seeing the entirety of Season 3, or at least towards the back end of Season 3.
I think you're right. I think they were releasing those special X-Files video releases faster than a lot of the other stuff was coming out or airing here. So, yeah, I guess that's entirely possible. Yeah,
and
it's a bit of a blur to me.
Especially with Millennium, I don't know. Yeah, but it is a blur. It is a blur. And as I say, when I watched season three, I remember tweeting about this when I was rewatching it, that I did struggle through it, as a lot of people have mentioned about the beginning, the first few parts of it. But I'm happy to report that so far, these three episodes so far, I haven't. So I think it's maybe slightly later and maybe in a couple of episodes time that I might struggle on one particular episode. But I'm going to wait until we get the delight of that one later. So
it's a teaser.
It is absolutely a teaser to my thoughts on an episode which involves a rock band and various other things.
I mean, I think that my overarching comment for season three would be just to, if folks engage with it on its own terms. So if anyone's watching for the first time or they're rewatching, engage with it on its own terms in terms of what the creatives are trying to do with the season. And I think you'll find there's much to enjoy.
The end of the world as we know it, which is a bit easier than actually trying to say Tiot Wawiki, which is an interesting term on its own. It's actually interesting when they use it within the episode as well. It aired on the 16th of October in 1998, and that's a particular date that we need to refer back to. Just off air, for those people listening, we just had to check on something, and we'll talk about that later on. It was written by Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz. So interesting in that Chris Carter is splitting his time at this point between LA and Vancouver. And this is his first written story for a while. And in fact, Frank Sputnik is on board as well and is directed by Thomas J. Wright. IMDb is interesting for season three as a whole, actually, because it hovers around this mark and it's 7.3 out of 10. But the numbers have dropped down significantly in voting. So it was 189 people voted. And this sees a shooting in a college. So, yeah. So let's talk about just the general aspects of this episode then, because it focuses in on school shootings, something that's still prevalent today, and issues that we've had with gun control and all kinds of things. Now, bearing in mind, we're both British, so, you know, we don't have the same kind of culture as America, for any Americans listening. So, you know, we're coming at this from a different culture base, really. But it has that. It has the Y2K bug as a kind of, as you kind of mysterious building up to the millennium end of the world aspect, which, you know, Millennium does so well. And it has, as I say, this theme of the parents kind of thing within it, while also kind of reset the way Millennium is told. And this, to me, and I'll get into this in a bit more detail later in a particular scene, does feel closer to an X-File than I felt for some time. So what do you make to this episode as a whole then? What would you rate out of 10? And, you know, what's your general thoughts on it before we get into any further deepness on it?
Yeah, so I do like this episode quite a lot, and I think it is notable that it's a script from Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz, and as you say, it's the first script from Chris Carter for some time. So I think it's significant in terms of, you know, his take on Millennium at this point in its run. I would give it a healthy 8 out of 10. I think. I think there were some interesting themes in here. I think some of the characterization and some of the interplay between some of the key characters, I think, is spot on and really, really quite noteworthy. And there's some very interesting, and salient themes, and topics touched upon in this that make it, I think, a good, solid installment.
Well, that's good to hear, because I was a bit concerned that, you know, we'd get into the first two or three episodes and people would be going, oh. But I would give it maybe 7.5. I've watched this twice in the last 2 days. I watched it just before coming on air now for this recording. And I watched it over the weekend. And the one thing that stood out to me is that X-Files element, that there was quite a few trademark bits on it. Now, that's not, and I'm not saying that as a bad thing, because I actually think the story itself is actually quite strong in some ways. And I do like some of the stuff that's portrayed in it. And it's an interesting take. And as I say, it's interesting where it lands in the show's run as well. So I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I did think, apart from remembering that Robert Wisden is in it, and the Y2K, and there's a shooting, that's pretty much all I remembered from before I did the rewatch. So in my head, it was a little bit forgettable, but I would base it more on the fact that it's more X-Files than anything else. But as I said, that's not a criticism in any major sense, really. What do you think to the themes then? There's the stuff with the, you know, the shootings and stuff like that. I mean, did you think that culminating the reason for the shooting behind it being that this Y2K bug was going to cause all the problems, and some of the commercial aspects with the Americans, you know, basically hiding this from the general public, and, you know, it would have commercial issues and commercial gain issues and stuff like that. Do you think that was deep enough for you?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, sort of superficially, you could say that perhaps the concept hasn't aged particularly well, and we always sort of laugh at the idea of the Y2K bug now. Although, so Frank Spotnitz was interviewed some years afterwards and said that, you know, actually in 1998, it was still quite, I think he called it an exotic concept. And the challenge for them was how to take this sort of an abstract fear and turn it into something scary and dramatic for the investigation. I see that aspect of it as, I guess if you read it as sort of emblematic for the sort of fears of the oncoming millennium and this sort of prepper mindset, then I find that
more interesting. You have to sort of overlook that these IT professionals would be so convinced that Y2K bug was going to bring down society in quite such a way as this. But I think on a as an allegory or as an emblem of the oncoming millennium, I think that's the most interesting way to think about it.
Yeah. So the fact that the Y2K bug didn't actually do much doesn't hate it.
Yes.
But no, I mean, to be honest, I mean, even like watching it, I recall it being much more of a bigger thing in the episode, and it's not really. And I think that looking back on it now, I actually think it plays out. It doesn't play out that bad. You know, I mean, it was an existential fear, but I like the way that it's the people with the IT kind of aspect to them, that they're the ones that are, you know, they're the ones that are hunkering down. They're the ones that are, you know, getting these guns and buying the fencing and preparing to do themselves. Very similar to what would happen in Force Majeure, thinking about it, actually. You know, it's very kind of that, you know, that aspect of like they're worried that, you know, that this thing is going to happen, and they're trying to keep it secret. And that's something I wanted to touch upon, actually, is the almost like the power. It's almost like, again, it's kind of as a relation to the X-Files in some ways, and a bit of an abstract one, is that there was a powerful group of people who knew that there's potential for this to happen, that they wanted to protect themselves and didn't want to tell other people because, you know, they're the ones that were going to survive it. And I thought that was really quite an abstract way of actually looking at the two.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting link to make, and yeah, I can see that absolutely.
Mm. So the cold open, because we'll get into get into the actual episode itself. So the cold open is obviously this. I think Russ has mentioned this in the mailbag, and it's quite a long mailbag that he's written. So I don't know if we'll get through it all. It's probably about 4 pages long, Russ. Please refrain from writing too much. But it is interesting in what he writes. But it starts off with the cheerleading of the Warriors and the actual gunshots being heard through the actual crowd and the like. And the use of these slow motion things that they've picked up. So it happens twice within the opening scene where you've got one of the characters, Skylark, as we come to know him as. You know, he looks at one of the cheerleaders and sees that, feels like the world is slowing down. And then when the gunshots go off, and that world seems to slow down at that point as well. And then you've kind of come to this silence with the girl screaming, which I think was quite effective, the girl screaming. But what did he make to the other elements of that opening credit scene?
Yes, so it's interesting what you said about what you remember from this episode. It's this teaser that I remember above all else, because to me it's one of the, it's one of the most shocking teasers of Millennium, I think. And it's in particular that sound design that you just mentioned that stands out to me. You get that sort of plaintive, horrific cry from the cheerleader right at the end of the teaser that haunts me, and that stood with me as much as anything else from this episode, I think, and that whole teaser. So it's I think we're shocking then, and it's shocking, just as shocking now, from the fact that as you say, we still sadly have these instances of school shootings and so on. So for me, it's quite a standout teaser and effective and horrendous.
Yeah, and we were saying off air as well that you've got some interviews from the Vancouver Sun, was it, where they talk about the Columbine shootings. But those shootings, well, I'd say we had to check this, but those shootings were after the fact. But it's interesting how they actually spoke to some of the cast about it. And do you want to give us some information on that while we're talking about the shootings themselves?
Yeah, sure. So it was the Vancouver Sun, and they spoke to them in late April, I think, as they were wrapping up on filming the series. It was on one of the last days of filming, and as they were doing perhaps a broader interview, they said that the killings were very much in the minds of the cast and crew. And So Lance Henriksen had spoken quite extensively in this and was talking about, you know, the reality of violence and the way that violence is depicted on television. And he says, you realize television doesn't even begin to show what violence really is. Think of the grief of the parents and of the victims. Think of the way those kids who live through that experience will have to deal with that for the rest of their lives. Television sanitizes reality, and that's really dangerous. And then he talks about, having been 3 years on the series and how he fought to keep the show honest. He says people say Millennium is so dark that it scares them. Well, that's what it's supposed to do. And he says in a lot of TV, death is sterilized, made antiseptic, it's trivialized. And let me tell you something, there's nothing trivial or sterile about death. So again, just saying that he thinks they've actually been quite responsible in terms of the way that they've shown this stuff and shown the real sort of horror of violent death on Millennium. Thomas J. Wright as well talks about how they've been very selective about what they show on Millennium and what they don't show. And that he always maintains that Millennium's about stopping violence and not glorifying it. So there's an element of sort of defending the way that they've shown, content like the content we see in this episode. And I think they're absolutely right that through not
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Sanitizing and through, yes, being selective what they show, but actually showing something that does portray something of the horror of these situations, that it's that much more meaningful.
Yeah, I mean, Spotnet has gone on to say, you know, that some of the, I mean, Millennium is a slightly different take on it, but I know he's talked about the X-Files where, you know, you take something fantastical like, you know, alien colonization of the planet in 2012, and you put that into the mundane. I think I mentioned this on the Innocence and the Exegesis last episode, actually. It was just fresh in the mind, but the Spotnet has always said that you live in, putting something on screen or making something like scary and you know terrifying is by putting it into the mundane. So like some 731, yes. You know, with the groups of women who had cancer who would abductees, but it led it to like a self-help group more than that, and how much fear there was there because it's in the mundanity of everyday life, and you know, basing it into a school. And
yes,
especially with some of the shootings that have taken place, and that it does give you that kind of, oh, you know, it's a real, and it's a real possibility, and that's what's really scary about it.
Absolutely, and then sort of meaningfully dealing with the aftermath. So if I can find this, so Claire Scott had said in here that yes, what I feel about Millennium is that it deals with what happens after a violent act, which is what I think makes it timely and important. I don't believe that examining the cause and effect of violence is trivializing it. So, I mean, you're right. It's a shocking environment to see something like this. But actually examining the aftermath of it is, again, helps to sort of examine the cause and effect. And I think it's what's part of what makes this episode quite powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, Barry Baldwin comes in. Now, I would like to get your opinion on Mr. Baldwin, just in general, because the first episode, I talked about this last week and the week before about his character, and that, you know, he comes across, Chris Knowles was very kind of complimentary towards him, saying, you know, it's a very rounded character, and, you know, he portrays what you would expect for a go-getter, that he's just like wanting to get up the ladder as quick and as efficiently as possible. But at the same time, something that I feel is that the way that he's drawn is that you've got like different shades. So you've got like Emma, for example, when she comes out of the car, she takes her time to come out of the car. She feels like she's the one that's the empathetic one.
Yes.
And she seems to be taking everything in and like dealing with it from that point of view. But he's like going in there and being demanding. So what do you think to Baldwin as a character as we head into this third season?
Yeah, he doesn't have a great start in episodes like this. That's kind of interesting. His interactions both with Frank and with Giebelhaus there's a certain sort of arrogance and presumptuousness to him that becomes, is undoing, but he becomes more interesting and he has something of an arc and an interesting arc as the season wears on. So I think ultimately he is a rounded character, but when you first meet him here, you kind of think, oh, okay, yeah. Bit of a jerk, bit of a know-it-all. Doesn't appreciate the experience that someone like Frank Brank brings, and of course, Frank talks about that as well, right? To McLaren quite early in the episode too. I think over the course of the whole season, he's quite an interesting character, and he does go on something of a journey.
Yeah, he does. But again, I mean, because obviously Emma Hollis has a different role to play in this, and obviously she's right front and center of the show with Frank and in this third season iteration. But what I find quite interesting is the way it, and I don't know if this is pointed at anything in particular. So please ignore my ignorance if I'm reaching here, but. The way the Baldwin goes in, it's true to the character that we've seen already. He's kind of incandescently raging and ranting at people, saying, you know, why are people taking it out? And Giebelhaus gets a great line, you know, great stuff for Giebelhaus to be back. And, you know, basically saying, I didn't want more black tape and stuff, which I thought was nice. It's humanistic.
It's a great line. Great line.
So I thought it was brilliant. But it's what I picked up on the second viewing was it seems that, you know, they seem to be pointing directly at what people miss, because Baldwin talks about the fact that, you know, we haven't surveyed the crime scene. And yet later on, Frank talks directly to Baldwin about the, you know, did you confirm, you know, I'm not saying you're wrong, but, you know, have you got the fingerprints from the trigger bits? And, you know, could it be the parent? Did you do the testing on the parents kind of thing? It seems like it's very pointed towards like sort of police evidence and kind of proceeds of crime kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think there are a few instances in this episode where you contrast characters who are disciplined and those who are undisciplined in different ways. And I think that's the contrast there is between the discipline that you have with Frank and also with Emma Hollis. So as you say, when she turns up to the crime scene, she's being very observant. She's sort of quietly watching and noticing things and identifying clues at the scene as well. Whereas Baldwin, who's quite undisciplined, has his own sort of assumptions that he's made, somewhat arrogant, thinks he knows better than even someone like someone as seasoned as Giebelhaus. I mean, that conversation was only going to end one way, right? When he starts having a go at Giebelhaus. That's a great scene.
It is, yeah. As I say, it just seems that, you know, Baldwin is the one at the moment, the point of view that we're seeing him is very much going like, you know, at Giebelhaus. It's quite interesting that they do that in the sense of, like, we know Giebelhaus, so we know him as a character. So the fact that, you know, we are being led down a path of not wanting to like Baldwin. And it's interesting how Chris Carter does these type of characters in some ways. I know potentially that he has had a bit of conversation with Chip Johansson and Michael Duggan and whatever, but the fact that, you know, you've got like Scully's brother, for example, and you've got someone like Former in later seasons of The X-Files, where you get these type of characters that do pop up. And it's like love to hate them kind of roles,
yes.
You know? So,
yes.
So it's, but yeah, so it seems like very pointed that, you know, Baldwin's the one that having a go at Giebelhaus, because everyone who knows Giebelhaus is going to defend Giebelhaus.
Yes.
Which just seems like it's a deliberate act there. But then the fact that he's been so, I think the point I'm getting at is that he's being so, like, you know, we might have missed something, and yet and he believes that he's so right in that. And yet, even later on, where he's talking to Emma, that and this reflects back on, I don't know if you watched the Innocence and Exegesis recently, but
yes, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. So when Emma's talking about the potential red flag, it's almost like a mirror of that as well, because Emma's talking about, you know, the fact it's only a hunch, which is something that Frank had said to her in the last couple of episodes, but yet he's ready to go, right, we've got ourselves our kind of, suspect, really, and he goes all out for Lever for it. So I quite like that aspect as well. I like the way that it seems to be quite clever writing. Whether or not it was meant, but it seems to have that shade to me, that there seems to be an interconnection between the two, three episodes. The scene that we move on to is this is where I think it feels most X-File, or the thing that for me, and it might be me putting my own like tinted glasses on this, but with the IT team around that table, it felt very Dejan de Villette's style. It almost felt like, you know, I know it's a Morgan and Juan thing to do, but it felt like you had this secret cabal of people withholding this information that had this information to them. You know, I know they're just testing stuff out, but it felt like these group of people that are working against, you know, the general public as a whole. And that to me felt like the teachers in that episode of Dejan de Villette. But again, I'm putting that on myself. But there's this corporate America thing though as well. The fact that, you know, it seems like none of us want to explain to our stockholders is what one of them says. You know, it's kind of like sort of, where's the line drawn? You know, there's this real threat that at the time we're talking about a real threat, as you say, that Spotnitz has said that, you know, it's not, it wasn't really out there as a potential bug at that moment, but it would soon come into the public consciousness about a year later. But it's kind of like, it's at that cusp of like, no one really knows, but we know, and we want to keep that between us. And that felt like it was just a really interesting take on the fact that, and another thing as well with it is later on when McLaren starts talking to Frank, it's like, why are you holding out on this case? You know, there's that development as well.
Yeah, he's afraid of big business and standing up to them, which, whilst of course Frank is more than happy to. But yeah, it's interesting. There was a quote from Chris Carter from around the time that this episode aired, and he wasn't necessarily talking about this episode specifically, but I'm sure the reference is there, where he said, people aren't really afraid of the millennium. That was never the idea of the show. But people are uncomfortable with the idea that we're heading into some unknowable kind of future and we're moving too fast technologically. And I wonder if that was there into.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun, Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Just some of the sort of considerations, but therefore that these big tech companies, know something that we don't, and they have too much power and control. I wonder whether that's sort of features in that as well.
Yeah, that's
which,
a good point.
Again,
yeah.
Still very relevant today.
Well, yeah, probably even more so in the fact that, you know, being us British at the moment, and probably around the world, that we're having this the delicate balance of being still recording in a pandemic. You know, we talked about this at the end of season two. We're still recording in the COVID-19 pandemic, and, you know, we're opening up the society at the moment as we record this. The scientists have basically said we've reached the limit and we might have to start doing trade-offs and stuff. But the actual thing now of, like, it's swung in the economy's favor for a few weeks, and now it's going back to the science, and it's that economy, culture kind of protection, health and safety balance that seems to be going around in the world today.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We're very protective of our sort of economic growth. Well, I mean, obviously, the economy falls apart and there's the health impact from that too. But, yeah. But there is that notion of governments and those in power protecting, protecting the interests of those who have wealth and influence. Yeah. Absolutely.
And again, like sort of the second time I'm watching this episode, I feel like that the more I think about it, the more that's laid in within this episode. And I think that, whether or not it's directly or indirectly pointed or some of the stuff that it's done is maybe done a bit on the nose. It depends on how you view it. But I mean, I personally, as I say, think this episode is actually quite good and a good one, a good third episode, to be honest. But we get to the scene and this again is a bit of a mirror here. And I don't know if this is a direct, I'm going to say this. I don't know if it's a direct shot at gun crime, gun laws and stuff. But we've got Frank, and it's a testament to what Frank is. There's a number of things happening in this scene. So Frank is using, he's at the gun range. He's obviously trying to get certified for holding a gun. And later in the episode, we've got the very end where we've got that Hollis asks about what you're putting down for the report, and he says, "Well, I didn't take a gun with me," and and that is very season one Frank, which I like, and season two as well. I mean, he got a gun because he was in season two purely because he was that it was that dangerous. So it's fair enough.
Yes,
But it's interesting that Frank is firing his guns. He's certified. He's And McLaren calls him out on how good a shot he is. And then later on, we find the IT experts all shooting at the range. And they're not, I wouldn't say they were bad shots, but they are not as refined. And they're the ones holding the guns and wanting to use them. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I noted exactly the same thing. And again, I would just come back to the word discipline. It's how disciplined Frank is, how sort of respectful he is and how capable he is with the gun. Yeah, and you can contrast that with these guys that are clearly quite undisciplined and not nearly as capable and don't have the same level of respect for the firearms. Yeah,
and it definitely feels like it's an actual pointedness to, there's a reasoning why we've recorded it in that way. And Frank being that Western kind of style, hero that doesn't want to use guns, wants to use his power of speech and stuff, which he does later in the episode as well.
He does indeed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also as well, there's this Just Kids and Guns reference in that scene as well.
Oh, that line. Yes. Yeah, and I love Frank's reaction to when McLaren actually says that, and I guess it's someone in McLaren's position who's seen it all too many times before, and has just sort of normalised it in a way that clearly Frank hasn't in the way that he responds to that line. Yeah, that's a great moment too.
It is, yeah, it's a telling line, isn't it? And I think they hold on that scene particularly well for to really push that home. Yeah, so I'm just going to have a quick look here. So we have talked about the fact of Baldwin when Baldwin goes to talks about the two reasons why the guns why he thinks that the kid had been shot in the head by himself, and then obviously Frank questions that, and I do like that line actually, because I like the way that Frank's saying, "Look, I'm not saying you're wrong," because that's something that I don't think you'd ever hear in another TV show. I don't think I've ever heard someone say, you the way you're doing it is wrong, but I'm not saying you are actually wrong. I'm just saying you haven't followed procedure, which is an interesting thing in itself.
Yeah. Again, he's quite measured and respectful, even when disagreeing on such an important point of procedure. Yeah.
When we get to the point where Frank is asking, I'm not asking you, I'm telling you, I'm going to go out there, and if you say no, I understand, I'm just going to turn in my credentials and go on for the good of it. There's a build-up of what's been happening in the end of season two, the 5 months that we've had between that and the Innocence. What happens in the Innocence and the fact that he's feeling like he needs to get back out there and to start doing things. Giebelhaus has actually reached out to Frank to do this, and obviously he's being kept away from it. What do you think to Frank's state of mind in the way that he comes out of season two coming into this episode? Because there is this eagerness for him to get back out there and just to do the good work. There's no real kind of aspect of Millennium in this one. It's kind of just a standalone episode. But there is this feeling that Frank just wants to get back out and do his job, really, isn't there?
There is. And of course, the two-parter that precedes this has dealt in part and with some of that fallout and some of the therapy that he's been through and so on. There is a hint at the end of that previous two-parter that that he's going to go after the group. And you do wonder if that's there in the background and in his motive to wanting to be... to want to be there at the FBI and have the opportunity to do so. But I do like that it's McLaren that says, you know, the fact that this is sending him back out to, you know, this is essentially him going home to where he used to live and where all those events of the end of season two played out, that he's not keen for him to go for those reasons. And I'm glad that that's touched upon, because it's not touched upon elsewhere in the episode. And that almost seems a little odd that there's not, you know, some exchange between Frank and Giebelhaus at some stage that acknowledges, you know, what's happened. But so I like that it's called out through McLaren in this way, and that idea that McLaren's looking out for Frank. But there's clearly a determination from Frank to want to do good work and feel he can contribute. But you do wonder if there's some other motive that he's got churning away in the back of his mind as well.
The next scene as well, which goes to attest to what Emma Hollis is like as well as a character, is that I talked again last couple of episodes about the relentlessness in which Emma will go and pursue something. Now, in the last couple of episodes, that's been very much a case of, you know, actually in some ways helping Frank by pulling him out of the mire that he was in. He was just like, go home, not interested. You know, I've given up the ghost in some ways. But
yes.
Emma pulls him out of that because of how relentless she is, you know, especially when she goes to that house and the burnt and goes to the hospital, the ICU in the previous two episodes. And in this one, she's, again, it balances out from, you know, thematically from her character that, in the previous episodes, she would have just come and knocked on the door, but she does actually say here, you know, it's like, I went round the block four or five times before thinking about it. And then we get the scene where it's actually from the credits as well, which is obviously where they've taken the credit scene from. But, you know, but there's also a little line with Jordan as well, which I quite like about, you know, what did they tell you about answering the door and find out who's there and some of the apologies and stuff like that. And the fact that Frank says, no, you know, she's not coming with me kind of thing. Which is interesting in itself. I know that obviously she hadn't convinced him at that point, but it is a nice little scene that.
I love that scene. It's one of my favourite scenes of the whole episode, actually, for the whole interplay between the three of them. So you've got Frank there being protective of Jordan, sending her upstairs when the conversation takes a particular turn and doesn't want her to hear the sort of worst parts of it. And then, it's very subtle, but it's the almost a notion of, I'm not going away with this woman, you know, with Jordan having lost her mother. And I don't know, that you just get a sense of,
I got that.
This is some new lady that's turned up in our lives, you know. That whole scene, I think, is very well played. And even, you know, just three episodes in, the interplay between Frank and Emma, which is so well done here as well. I think I called out in the primer that Emma Hollis was my favorite character, apart from Frank Black. And I think it's so how they've really hit the ground running in terms of the chemistry between the two of them, but that particular type of chemistry that they have, and for how well scenes such as these quiet scenes play out. And even so earlier in the episode where they're questioning Baldwin, and you just get these looks between Emma and Frank and so on. I think all of that stuff is...
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
It's so well done.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was something I was going to bring up, actually, because there is a few in this episode where there's just a look that Clea Scott gives Lance Henriksen, and it's like, and Baldwin's in the vicinity as well, and it's like, Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I quite like that. Especially given the scene where Baldwin at the end of Exegesis is like really smug, the fact that Frank's actually in the interview room with the woman and doing the confession, and she's been left alone because basically Frank's protecting her at that point. But the way that Baldwin's quite smug towards it, and I think that's why some of the dynamic works this early on with the three of them, because it's a dichotomy of the characters. But I did pick up, as you say, I did pick up that Jordan, you know, because even in the last episode we had the plate settings, the extra plate settings and things, and the fact that Jordan's asking, are you going to go with this woman? It did feel like, you know, and it's done in a way that it's not done from a, you know, we want to raise sexual tension between these two people. It's done through the fact of Jordan's lost somebody, and is this person replacing them? As you say, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's very subtle, but it's definitely there, and I think all the better for how subtly it's done.
Both at the beginning and the end of the episode as well, there's the mention of this book. Now, the book's within this scene as well. That you know, they're talking about the days are numbered, history counting backwards to count forward to a new dark age. What did you make to putting this in? Because this is kind of a quite a millennium thing to do, to have these kind of scripture and these elements to it. But the Book of Hours is very straightforward in what it's saying about, you know, the fact that we could be hitting a new dark age. What did you think to having these monologues and using this book within the Skylark situation with you know, the warnings and stuff?
I do love the monologues, the Carter monologues and soliloquies. So I love how that sort of bookends the episode. And I do like that this is thrown in for something that is quite millenniumistic.
I refrained from saying that before I said it, but I was like, I'll let you go.
I couldn't help myself.
Yeah.
But I think it also fits well with the whole Y2K element. So, you know, literally entering a dark age. So if all our technology were to fail today, you can see, given how much data is how much of all the data that sums up who we are and the age that we're living through is held digitally. Yeah. It would lead to a dark age. So I think it's very effective to talk about the dark ages and introduce a text like that in the context of this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next scene is where we've got Hollis, Frank, and they're interviewing Kathy, the ex-girlfriend. And the one thing that I keep referring back to this is when Gable House pulls the can thing. And she jumps.
Yes.
And
yes,
for a number of different reasons, I think that's effective. I think it's effective because Kathy's been in a position where she's obviously scared, and, you know, any loud noise is going to affect her. It's also it's a jump scare because, you know, it's a very loud can. but it's also quite intelligent with Gable House as well. So I think it works on multiple levels, really.
It does, yeah. It sort of conveys a lot of that sort of PTSD or whatever that Kathy's suffering from. But yeah, it's one of those little sly Gable House comedic moments that we love.
Yeah. Just for prosperity, I'm going to mention this, and this is nothing to do with Millennium. It's got nothing to do with anything. But I went into my car 2 days ago. On the Friday, we had our hottest day of the year so far. And what I didn't realise is that I'd left a can of IPA in the car. And I went in, I opened the car door at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I was like, all this sticky stuff, like literally all over the car. I've got leather seats in my box all last day. And I was like, what on earth has happened here? Thinking the other half's done something or whatever. And then I saw the can, and the can was like obliterated. So it's obviously pressurised and just blew up. And it just went everywhere. And I was just like, when I saw this scene, I just imagined just how much of a noise and how much of an explosion that can would have made in the car.
This is where you weren't driving at 60 miles an hour when it happened.
Yeah. It would have been a nightmare, because there's literally, there'll be drink there now forever and a day, and I'll be still cleaning it in 2 years' time, but it was quite scary.
Oh, no.
But yeah, that's just for prosperity. So when I listen back to these recordings in 20 years' time, I'll remember that. All right. Okay. So what do you think to the situation with Brant Carmody and the dad? Obviously, you know, I mentioned about him portraying about Robert Wise and playing Pusher and stuff like that previously, but as the characters, the fact that, you know, Frank gets his vision and he sees that he does feel that he did kill those kids because of basically because of what he's been told, and that he believes that, you know, he's been murdered. He didn't kill himself. What do you make to that? One, that family unit and this kind of the do all anything to protect yourself kind of thing that the dad is portraying here, but also the pure like existential crisis that Brent had to go through to actually get to that point, that breaking point where, you know, he thinks all is lost.
Yeah, it's pretty bleak. The more you think about it, the bleaker it is. But that idea of how hopeless you must feel the future is to have done what he done, and but then how that's Brant, but in terms of Chris, the father, Robert Hoisland's character, what sort of a person could do that to protect their own self-interest? I guess it just shows how far he's prepared to go and how unhinged he is with the beliefs that he has, that even at the cost of one of his children supposedly in his own crazed imaginings, that that's going to somehow protect the rest of his family. That it's pretty unhinged and pretty bleak when you think about it. Someone's prepared to go to those lengths.
But even like sort of when they go to that fire, back to that fire range, which I mentioned before, that he says, I've taken care of it, it's all been done. It's almost like he's, you know, that just a part of him just isn't willing to accept it. It's all on the end of the world kind of aspect.
Yes.
He's not emotionally attached at all. And it's really interesting that is. And I like the interplay as well with that, because if you convert that to what Carlton is doing and Carlton's dad towards the end, you know, and how the two different parents have reacted, and the fact that, you know, that the Carlton's dad's obviously got more has more of a connection with his son than he does. So it's an interesting concept there as well, and I like the fact that they've got that balance within that community.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, and of course, there's the fact that there's Frank there to reason with him and have him see reason before he does something really stupid.
Yeah, because I always think that at that point, the two scenes towards that end of that scene is when Carlton stands in the way. Now, you know, if it had been the fact that it would have been Robert Wiseman's character, then, you know, would it have turned out differently, because he's standing in the way, and you actually feel, in some ways, you feel a bit scared, because like, what will these people do to go to the lens? Will he actually kill his son here? So it actually builds a bit of like tension.
It does. Yeah, very effectively. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I think I do have to mention, I half mentioned it before, but I have to mention the line that Gieberhaus says to, what's Robert Wiseman's dad called? Could you say it was Carl?
Chris Carmody, yeah.
So we said, well, that's interesting, because I love this, because this feels like Gieberhaus has learned so much in the, you know, the two prevailing years that we've not seen him really for a while. I know we saw him in Doomsday Defense, didn't we? I don't think, did we see him anything else after that?
I don't think so.
I don't think we did we? So the fact that he's like, he's learned from Doomsday Defense, because I know there's a bit of like interplay with that, but the fact that he's saying the coroner's pathologist said that your son still had toothpaste in his mouth, brushing his teeth, and that he found him dead in his jammies, which always like throws me off when he said it, but it's like, it's great. It's a Gieberhaus thing to do. It's totally in character, and I like it. And I do like the fact that, you know, there's real willing for Gieberhaus there. He's like, you know, he's wanting to get to the bottom of it. He absolutely believes that he didn't commit suicide, that it is the dad's fault. And then you've got Carmody saying, and that's what you're basing this on. You know, you're going to need a lawyer, aren't you, kind of thing. Which, it's a line you can just imagine that happening. But I do love the fact that, you know, you've got Gieberhaus actually conveying that he is an intelligent police detective. He knows what he's doing. He's just got a unique style about him.
Yes, and you often don't see enough of that, do you, from Gieberhaus, as you say. So yeah, it's nice to see him doing some actual detecting. Yeah.
the only thing, like, okay, this is a bit of a criticism for me, and I still have a little bit of struggle with this, and I hope you can help me with this, right? Mm-hmm. So when Hollis is going through the printer, and we see Skylark, and Skylark is threatening to kill. What we see as an email threatening to kill him, and that was the basis of, you know, what Baldwin does. What did he make to that whole scene and the story behind it? What do you read from that? Because I'm not convinced I quite understand it. I think I know where it went and what it was trying to portray, but I'm not sure it's clear enough on screen. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it does, I guess it gives you some tension as to quite who's done what. It's not necessarily a real tension. I guess it at least gives Carlton the drive to then act as he does and turn up at the hotel and threaten Frank and Emma in the way he does, which then propels on through the episode. I guess that's the purpose it casts in the story. It's not like it really effectively sets up some tension as to exactly what had happened. I think we sort of figured out what's really going on by this point, haven't we? It's fairly clear.
Yeah, it just feels a bit like convoluted. It doesn't feel... I never can quite get to grips with what they're trying to get at. I think it's almost like, you know, oh, Baldwin's got this piece of information which Hollis was trying to hide. But,
right.
Yeah, it doesn't... I don't quite know what I know from a narrative point of view what they're trying to do. They're trying to take the onus off, you know, off Chris. But then, it just feels a bit, I don't know, it doesn't feel quite right to me how it was all set up.
I know what you mean. It doesn't fit quite right. I guess it's another instance of perhaps a Baldwin getting perhaps slightly the wrong end of the stick. It's like he's trying to get one up on his fellow investigators. That seems to be his motive half the time, rather than actually trying to solve the crime in question.
Yeah, and then obviously we get Frank, you know, asks about which I love. You know, it's typical 90s speak, saying, "Can you get the internet service provider to find out who Skylark is? Do it quickly. Do it quietly."
Yes.
Because his life is going to be in danger. Again, I think you're right by the, it's the necessity to build some tension when there is, doesn't really feel like there's anything there. And that'll be a criticism I have of this episode. This is probably the main one. I'm kind of like, not quite sure I'm on board here. You know, so I think that there's a bit of an issue there. So they're doing the background check, and what I find really interesting here is just the lengths that the group are going to, the amount of stuff that they're getting to, the things on there, which is like gas generators, solar paneling, barbed wire, non-perishable food. The list goes on, you know, which is what Frank says. They've got M16 assault rifles. They've got, you know, and it's in when they start talking about the weapons, it feels very much like. And I don't mean to allude to the X-Files on this because I'm not, but it's just the field where I died, where they're hiding the weapons.
Yes.
It's kind of like your Waco and kind of aspect of that. You know, it's almost like they're expecting a siege.
It does evoke a little bit of that. And just the whole, I guess the whole prepper mindset, which is, I guess it's something we have here, but not in quite the same way as you had or have in the United States. So, again, I think it fits, whether it quite goes with the character of the sort of people you would imagine running an IT company. I don't know, but I get, it feels like something that it fits the world of Millennium, that these people preparing in this way for what they see as the oncoming end of the world feels, I won't say Millennium is sticking up, but again, it just feels like it fits with the themes of the series very well.
It does. I actually like it. I think it's interesting that, you know, they've done the let's go out, let's go in a high place, in a mountain at a hotel. This will be our you know, Noah's Ark kind of thing. This will be our ark to save humanity. You've got the you know, the fact that we can change the future in The Innocence and Exegesis in the last two episodes with you know, by the remote viewers that goes into it, and then you've got these people here who are kind of hoarding and, you know, knowing that the world is going to irrevocably change in 2000 with the change of the computers and everything going down, that they're getting everything together and they think that they know that this dark age is coming and they're ready to protect it and to defend it in the way that they're doing. And I think it's an interesting play on stuff that we've seen before.
Yeah, it is. And as crazy as it seems and as crazy as it is, it's, you know, there are people who think and behave this way. Yeah. It's as far out as it may seem to you or I, it's,
yeah.
There are people that do actually think and behave in exactly this way.
Yeah. I mean, I could totally see this group of people being a group of people that we'd meet in The Walking Dead, for example. Yes. Let's find a their backstory, but that's another story. So with Frank, when Carlton comes out, when Skylark, as he's called, comes to the door, we get the knock and we get the the ad break as such, and you know he's saying go back, get back up, go inside, kind of thing. There's a nice little couple of stages off with Hollis and Frank there as well, isn't there? There's like little touches where it's like don't kind of thing. And
yes, absolutely, yeah. They're into place so good, yeah. You know, at this early stage, yeah.
And what I actually do like is the breakdown, because you know you'd expect in the most TV shows that you'd get some sort of like either talk down in some way, or they would figure a way of actually getting round him and taking the gun away from him. But I like the fact he just breaks down. I think that's really, really good character arc for Carlton, really.
It is for Carlton, and again, just showing the sort of empathy that that Frank has in terms of how skillfully he and quickly he manages to talk him down as well. Both for Carlton's arc and also this sort of assured version of Frank that, as you said, is quite a season one Frank that we get.
And we get that, don't we, in the final scenes when we do end up at the field where, you know, they're disabling the cars because they don't have the firepower. At the end of the day, they don't. And then we get to the point where he does have to talk to Gary and talk Gary down, saying, you know, this is not a war and there's no enemies here. Put the gun down. And show your son, and that is very, very kind of season one Frank, and something that we've not necessarily seen too much of in season two, but not this style of Frank either, not this style of show anyway. So it's something that I actually quite liked on this, and I quite like the direction of it as well, because Thomas J. Wright is obviously he's a seasoned pro at this point for the show, and I think he directs this episode quite well, to be honest.
Yes, absolutely. He's Mr. Millennium, as they call him. Yeah.
Mr. Millennium. apart from that, really, unless there's anything that I've missed, I know I've kind of loosely gone over the end scene, but it's fairly self-explanatory with the final third act kind of thing. You know, it's very set piece. It's ready to roll out, and you know, there's a couple of gunshots here and there, and obviously Frank doing what he needs to do, and then we get the voiceover at the end, and obviously the scene I mentioned before about the guns being fired and Frank not doing that. I know there's scenes where he takes out the the duffel bag and he's got the FBI badge in there, which I thought was nice. It looked like an old, it definitely didn't look like a Mulder and Scully badge. It definitely looked like ex-FBI. I don't know how the FBI works. I don't know if that means that because you're an FBI agent in the, you know, maybe the 60s or the 70s, that you just keep the same badge, potentially.
I don't know either, no. But, yeah, it does seem to be of a particular vintage, doesn't it?
It does seem to be a vintage. And obviously, I think as well, some of the interplay that Thomas Wright does there by really concentrating on the gun, again, because of the type of episode it is and what Frank actually does, you know, the difference, the dichotomy between the fact that he has a gun but he never actually takes it out of the bag, really. And as you say, the difference between the IT guys who are willing to do that and Frank, who's like sort of more disciplined in that way, I think really works. But yeah, that brings the episode to an end. So, do you have anything else you wanted to bring up with regards to the episode?
Yeah, I mean, it is just in terms of the ending again, just how the what you can achieve through skill and experience as opposed to brute force and relying on such violence. I think it's a powerful message, and I think it's very well told, and I think this is a great script and a great episode, and I do like the as I said, the quotes that bookend this, and I think so. I talked about discipline a bit, and that comes up again in the in that final quote that Frank has, where he talks about, you know, the radical few who obey no disciplines, unencumbered by conscience, and prepare ruthlessly, pursuing their own preservation. That's a perfect way of summing up how Chris Carmody and the folks there have have behaved. And I think, I mean, you could say that this is a little heavy-handed with the little quote at the end, but I love it. And he says, you know, if they survive, the rest of us perish. None will weep for the civilized, the principled us, except God himself. And I think that's it's a great final line, and leaves you with something to think about. And I think the episode as a whole, as I say, we only get a few installments written by Chris Carter in the season. This is the first one, and it does. I know he talked again around the time before the season came out how he had lots of ideas and things he wanted to insert, and he'd had long conversations with Lance before the season, and then it doesn't then feel as though he is particularly involved, and I guess that's purely the schedule of, as you mentioned, running the X-Files out of Los Angeles at the same time. So perhaps he had all good intentions of being more involved in the season, but and perhaps he was to more than extent that we realise behind the scenes. But I think it's this episode and the other episodes that he writes with Frank Spotnitz are worth spending time with and looking at in great detail for being his final sort of statements on the series as he returns to it this year.
Mm. Yeah, it'd be interesting if we could like be the fly on the wall at the times when this was being aired and stuff, like some of the character themes, some of the arc on that. I mean, not necessarily the grander like evil themes. Yes, we've got things like 7 and 1 and whatever when we come to them, but it just like this does seem at this in these three episodes there is some interconnectivity between what Chris Carter's written here with Frank Spotnitz and the previous two episodes. It does feel to me like there is something. It's just how far does that go? And it'd be interesting to just have that in the back of my mind as I go through this season, because the majority of the season I think I'm going to be on anyway, as always. It'd be interesting to see just with that in the back of my mind whether or not there does seem to be some interplay or some like character beats that maybe that Chris Carter was involved in.
I it's worth reflecting on. As you say, I think there's something that does fit thematically from this episode, as you mentioned about sort of parent, father and son, and sort of the parent-child dynamic that comes through in this, and just the whole idea of us being shepherds for future generations and the choices that we make. I do think this fits very well thematically into the broader season as well. But yeah, in terms of those character beats, worth reflecting back on those as you go through as well.
Absolutely. Right, okay, so we'll call that a day for the episode as a whole. We do need to go into the mailbag. There's one on Twitter, and Russ Hugo, as I said, has mentioned one. I didn't like copy and paste and see how many words there is, but we'll try and get through some of it, Russ. So I think I'll go to the Twitter one first. So just before we do that, let's have a look into the mailbag. Okay, so Oscar Groucho says, early prescient, Chris Carter's chamber piece rather than orchestra. The angst of youth and the talons of despair combining to provide a somber hymn to the ethos of millennium. Underrated in a show that's still recalibrating from the change in format. Yeah, I mean, I mentioned about the feel of, there's elements of the X-Files feel to this. I'm not one that would explicitly go out and say it's a bad thing. I think this episode actually works quite well because of it. And, you know, the Hollis and Frank character is interesting in that way because it's a mentor, not a sexual attention thing. And I know that Chip Johannesson has said that they didn't want to go down that way. But yet, like season one with the serial killer of the week, like what we'd say is unfairly said, yes, it has some basis, but I think it's unfair on it. I think that this has the same for season three, that it's X-Files light as such. Well, not X-Files season six light, but a millennium version of X-Files. And I think there's, for me personally, I think, yes, there's touchstones for it, but I don't think it's bad because of it. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. And I think, I know what you're saying about the X-Files influence, but I also think you can't underestimate the influence of Millennium on the X-Files as well.
It's
very much a sort of cross-pollination between the two, but as you say, not a bad thing. And I think so the whole serial killer of the week comment that gets thrown at season one, I think really when you look at season one, a lot of it's just about human tragedy in the way that this episode is also centered around human tragedy. And I think that that comes through and perhaps is something of a thematic link as well.
Yeah, and I could see this episode being in season one. Definitely, it definitely has that more than like seasons. The first two episodes is an amalgamation of pretty much everything, and it has to do that. It has to draw the lines between season one and season two, and we discussed that in the last couple of weeks. But this one does feel like it's as Oscar Groucho says there. You know, it's still recalibrating a little bit, but I do think it's good for it. Right, let's talk on Facebook. Russ Hugo. Okay, I'm going to give this a go. I might end up saying four words and saying, it's cut. Okay, so he says, before I started this comment, I didn't think I had much to say about this episode, but the more I thought about it, the more I found to be bothered or bored by it. From season two onwards, the writer seems to be less accurate with the location names in the Pacific Northwest of the US. I have to work out what PNW meant there. Russ, come on, give us a favour. We're English. It says, Redland is clearly intended to be Redmond, the home of Microsoft. I mean, ComLogic. Did the legal landscape change after season one, or did standards and practices win the battle in season two? Okay, that's fine. There are some really brave and interesting ideas here, but the follow-through is too tame and muddled. This could have worked well in season one or season two. It filmed with the edge that In Arcadia Ego had, or amped up the mysticism of Amnesis. I could understand that the flat direction and production, if they were motivated by the seriousness of the topic of school shootings, but it feels like no one making this episode cared about the script, and who could blame them? In the cold open, there are many ideas presented that go nowhere. These are references, maybe unintentional, to indigenous colonization and apocalypse, the high school mascots being the Warriors, commonly had indigenous peoples as their mascots. My local school, high school, growing up had the same. Then, of course, there are colour-based references, red land and red, white, blue fight nationalism. We have a creepy proto-incel character. That's an interesting comment. We'll come back to that in a second. That is somewhat redeemed, ? By the script. Corporate involvement in school funding and class divide, as well as school shooting. In the end, the script boils down to a bland stew about survivalist technocrats and the Y2K. Right, I'll leave it there just for now. And we'll talk about, what do you think to that comment about the proto-incel character then?
So, yeah, there is a point in the episode where you could say that's a sort of misdirection that we're given, and perhaps it's playing with that stereotype. But because it's not, you know, he's not the one who's ultimately responsible. Yes, he has some slightly inappropriate behaviour in terms of the unwanted gift of the book and so on. But yeah, I see. I don't necessarily have a problem with it as it's shown in here, because ultimately that's a character that is redeemed and actually, well, he stands up to his own father in a way that helps to resolve the episode. So
I didn't see it as incel until I literally just read that there. I didn't think of it in that way. I did think that he's a character that is going through a lot of change. He's an adolescent child who's, you know, dealing with these feelings that he might have for that particular cheerleader in mind, that he needs an outlet, and that's his outlet to kind of pass on the stuff that he knows. And, you know, he's being given so much information about what would be the end of the world. How does someone react to that?
Go
on.
I wouldn't necessarily use the term incel. I think it's perhaps pushing it a little far, but I get that reading of it.
It's an interesting reading, definitely. I didn't think about that until, as I say, I've just read it there. So he continues on to say, the idea of children being unable to cope with apocalyptic anxiety is interesting and could have been the focus, e.g. Amnesis. But instead, after everything, the episode doesn't go anywhere or do anything of substance with any of the more challenging ideas. It's a mess of surface symbolism that uses shock to make the viewer do all the work. Unfortunately, the script, direction, and acting make it very hard for the viewer to want to do any of the work. There is some really rough acting in this episode. It's possibly Wright's weakest work on Millennium, and I wonder how much of this is to do with the production issues of early season 3 or the script. The opening and closing monologues are a succinct summary of the episodes and some of season 3. I'll reread that. The opening and closing monologues are a succinct summary of the episode's muddiness and structural problems. And he's referring to season 3 there. The first monologue is almost camp on how the nose is untethered from reality it is. The second is just a ball of confusion and pedantic nonsense. And I think he then quotes the actual stuff. Basically, everyone will know about the catastrophe, but not believe or do anything. And the only people who believe and do something will be selfish. These people will then be destroyers of everyone else. Why not simply address the issue of hoarding and violence? Instead, it's everyone who believes there's an issue and works to solve it before it's too late, e.g. climate change, which is an issue in the 1990s as well. That's the problem. The quote seems very much pointed towards the Millennium Group and its current status, and so the quote really only serves to hammer home the in-universe mythology change while making a very weak statement on survivalists in an episode where the main issues should be school shootings and child psychology. The episode is not a complete disaster, but it's a disappointing, muddled mess. It's hard to take seriously, considering the topics that it's trying to address. It's fairly tragic, as so much more could have been done with the premise, and at least we get to see Geeba House again. and that's where he ends. So thanks, Russ. As always, it's always nice to have people's opinions on it. And I think he's got a few comments there, like I'd say for the incel, which I'd welcome. Some of the Americanism stuff I'm not too au fait with, so I don't think I'm in the right position to comment on them, to be honest. But.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I disagree with most of that, but I respect the opinion and the response. Clearly a genuine and thoughtful response to the episode. But I don't have a lot of those same problems with it. There are quite a lot of threads to this, and okay, yes, could you focus more on the child psychology angle and so on? Yes, but I think that's perhaps. I do think there's a coherent idea or coherent ideas behind this, and that the quotes that we have that bookend the episode, I think are quite poetic, and I think they're quite effective too. But that's entirely fair response. Incidentally, so there's another reference of Giebel House there, and I was just checking in the background. I think we're underserving Giebel House for other episodes that he showed up in season 2. Yeah, so he showed up in Siren and a couple of others as well. So he did a handful of appearances through season 2 that we're perhaps
looking towards. To be fair, Siren is an episode I keep forgetting.
So, and again, it is awful that I'm having to rely on IMDb. I should know better than this. And I apologise to Stephen J. Lang and to Giebel House. But Goodbye Charlie, Rooster's Room with No View.
Oh, well. Yeah, I do remember him in Goodbye Charlie, actually, and Room with No View. Yeah.
Yeah,
so I didn't. I'll use the excuse that I didn't cover A Room with No View. Well, that's what I'm going
to
say. Yeah,
there you go. Anyway, sorry, but that's to pick up on one side note from Ross's comments there. But brilliant. Interesting. I don't have nearly as many of those problems. I think the idea of that we passed over that he mentioned about corporate involvement in funding of the school is an interesting point because, that's right there, front and centre at the moment of the shooting and perhaps is a quite pointed in terms of the moment when the shooting takes place. It's kind of a hint or a clue as to the true motive, in terms of the sort of symbolism and the script direction and even the direction, I didn't have problems with those things, but no, respect Ross's response to it.
Yeah, I think with you saying about the actual scene, I mean, it's strangely enough, that's the scene where the $2 million sign gets thing is the actual GIF file that I decided on using for the question, and they touch up on it very, very. I mean, we've talked about it, but they touch upon it a little bit with McLaren and Frank, and them talking about the actually within the scene. But I get his point that it's not like as overt as it could be. Maybe edited out. It may be not done, or it might not be drafted through. But it does seem to be something that they've abstractly touched upon very, very slightly, but maybe not gone to as much depth as it could have. And I appreciate the line where he's saying about why do we not simply address the hoarding and violence? And like you say, some of the stuff that you might have got in things like the well-worn lock, for example, you might have got more of that. But it would be a slightly different episode at that point. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of ideas that have gone into this episode, and yes, you could have chosen to explore some of them in more detail. But that between them, Frank and Chris obviously made different creative choices. But you could equally have gone another way. I think that speaks to the sheer range of ideas that have gone into the episode.
Absolutely. Well, that calls the episode to a close. So. You will be back with us later on in the season. You're coming back for Through a Glass Darkly. So that'll be 3 or 4 weeks away. We've got a very interesting episode for you next week where we're going to have a solo host. There's not going to be a guest. So I'm going to leave that dangling and hopefully you'll come back and have a listen to it. It's a very interesting special edition of The Time Is Now, and we're going to be covering Closure as normal. But we're doing it in a unique style. So this is our... This is our kind of like Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense version of The Time Is Now. We're going off kilter. We're not going to the usual standard of hosts and guests. We're going to something different. But until then, where can people find you online, Adam? And as I say, we'll see you in a few weeks. But where can people find you online?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter, Adam_Chamberlain, spelled BRLN at the end, and also at fourthhorsemanpress.com.
Excellent stuff. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at R Muldrake. That's RMULDRAKE. To find out what I'm doing, I've got plenty of things on the go at the moment. Obviously, The Time Is Now is back. It's always a great thing. We are 3 episodes in to the season. I once I get halfway through, I think I'll be feeling a bit melancholy, as I know it'll be coming to an end soon, which will be a sad time. But still a lot to do before we get there. You can also find me on the Red Dwarf podcast that I'm now doing, which is at Red Dwarf Pod. And that will be a podcast on Red Dwarf, on all the specials that have been out through the summer. And we will be on seasons 2 to 4, somewhere around season 2 to season 4, somewhere around there at the time this airs. So I think it'll be season 2 that we'll be on. Yes, it will be season 2. So we'll be on at season 2 when this airs. So look forward to seeing that. Obviously, you'll find me on the XCast. We've just completed the Fight the Future Minute, which was us going through the Fight the Future film minute by minute. So we've had a whole round of hosts and guests on that, of which I was included on there. I was guested and hosted on that show. You'll hear likes of Darren Mooney on there, people you've heard on this podcast as well. So plenty for you to get your teeth into, and no doubt you'll find me next year talking about season 2 of Picard as well. But until next time, thank you everyone for coming. Thank you, Adam, for being a guest on the show again. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having me again. Thank you.
But until next time, remember, this is who we are.
Elsewhere on We Made This. We are Starfleet.
Honestly, it felt so great to see the Starship Discovery again.
Yeah, out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Right into the fire. So in our previous episode, I had commented on how I felt like all the dramatic tension that the writers built up with Burnham falling kind of felt like, all right. But here, I felt the exact opposite. It just seemed like the right blend of tension and risk and what's at stake.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, and I think there's a couple of reasons for this. One, I think...
The Giddy Carousel of Pop.
So there's one particular thing where I think Sylvia just nails the Mannix, absolutely nails them, and nails them to this day. And she says, the Mannix mission is a simple one. They want to make music exciting, glamorous, and interesting again. Make people wake up out of the boredom and meaninglessness of 20th century life and jump up and down to some good old rock and roll music and think about things and have a laugh, because at the end of the day, none of us will ever be happy. And I had to have everything about them immediately.
The Movie Palace.
Before we even think about the book, I suppose, were you coming to this as a Marilyn Monroe fan, particularly?
No, not at all. In fact, I'll admit, this is very awful, but I knew almost nothing about Marilyn Monroe. I mean, I knew of her. She's a cultural icon.
Yeah.
I would say she's even gone beyond that now, and she's almost a symbol. So I knew of her. I had seen a few movies that she'd been in, although to be honest, whenever I watched those movies, I wasn't really focusing on her because she was sort of in the background.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.